and minutes without we know where he is. And he never, repeat, never talks to any kind of police, no pigs or any other farm animals, local cops, FBI, old Mother Hubbard, same for you. Absolutely. Pure comes round, you don't have the foggiest idea where he went. We get hinky in the least, Seth so much as has a cup of coffee with a meter maid, we call the FBI and tell them just where they can find little Seth. We bolt for Algeria, and he heads for Slam City to do 18 months to 3. Are you following me?
I have the entire picture, my father said.
Goodbye.
She called back in 40 minutes.
Any questions?
None, my father said.
The money cool?
I have spoken directly to the banker. The funds will be wired before the end of the day. The casino is on alert and will oblige Seth whenever he arrives.
No problems?
None whatsoever. The banker was somewhat curious, but I explained that for some time, as a hobby, I have been studying the laws of probability and blackjack. He was quite interested and recommended a book.
Far out. Here's your son.
Dad, I'm sorry. I meant it, of course. In triumph, I was wretched and remorseful. He didn't answer. He was, I was sure, torn by unbearable emotions, insane with rage, and washed clean by the relief of hearing my voice.
I want to be sure you understand what happens afterwards, I said.
You will call us.
I meant after that. The FBI will be looking for me, within a few weeks. You won't be able to call me, to write me. Do you understand? Nothing that will trace.
Your mother will not endure that.
I'll call every few days, a payphone, just so you know I'm okay. That's all I can do.
Will we know where you are?
It will be a lot safer if you don't, really. If you can just say, I don't know, when those people show up. I don't want you guys to get in trouble.
Trouble, my father repeated.
My lord, says.
But as the shape of what was ahead settled in, he voiced no further complaint. This fit my father's needs too well. He would never see through it. Were it not for the pain of surrendering the money, he would regard all of this as perfect.
Is Mom okay?
She knows nothing.
Great. Look, it'll be all right.
I pray, my father answered. Afterwards, I sat with my hand still on the phone while I wrung myself out one more time. It was over now, in all practical respects. I'd done the worst, and everybody had survived. No one had had a coronary. No one knew they'd been betrayed. I waited now to experience the uncertain mood of freedom. The traffic fumes, the wine from the road, flapped in with the curtains as they were tossed by the wind.
You know, there's a lot of cruelty in life, Seth,
June said, behind me.
That surgeon who saves your life, there's a little part of him that lacks the blood when he cuts.
Which one of us are we talking about? I asked, although I had no doubts. I was dangerous and neurotic. I would have to accept that about myself, but I took no pleasure from the fact. I already sensed the bilious weight that would fall over me whenever I thought about this episode for the rest of my life. But for June, I could see epic events were an essential measure. The heat of the spotlight, the rush of applause. Things that go boom, change, catastrophe, a new lover at night. She was turning out to be easier to comprehend than I had imagined.
I was trying to let you know how I look at this, she said.
You're helping something important. I know this riles you up. I can see it's painful. But we all make sacrifices for the revolution.
The phone rang then. June listened and said nothing before she put down the handset.
You might find Tuttle at Africa House, she said. And be careful. There's a lot of irresponsible behavior with Cleveland inside. He kept his entire cell in line. That's another reason we need him out. Let's say 1 hour.
She looked at her watch. I rooted in my pocket for my car key, then turned back. What's Edgar's sacrifice? I asked.
For the revolution.
She studied me for some time.
His faith,
she said. A clock clicked. A horn on the highway tore off in a dopplering wail. She knew, somehow, that her remark was harder on me than her. And what's yours? I asked.
I stay with Edgar,
she answered at once, and, without looking further at me, reached out for her book, which still lay on the bed. Crossing the Damon campus, I encountered a festival atmosphere. This morning, the faculty had voted to declare the university on strike. Classes had been suspended indefinitely so that students could engage in letter-writing campaigns and community organizing. But they seemed impressed to have accomplished their own liberation, and in spite of a certain freneticness, the campus held some of the joyous air of the weekend. Stereos boomed from the windows, and people milled in the plazas and green spaces. Bedsheet banners hang from the windows of the dormitories. A closed fist of a brilliant, urgent red was stenciled on each sheet beneath which a single word was set forth. Strike. Walking toward the quad, I was handed a mimeoed flyer. Stop Nixon's War Machine, Ohio State, Laos, New Haven, Cambodia, Vietnam. Nationwide student strike. Strike before it's too late. Strike for knowledge. Strike for sanity. Strike for yourself. Strike for peace. Strike, strike, strike. In the main quad, an open mic speechathon was underway. One anti-war speaker after another, faculty and students, reviling Richard Nixon to the celebration of enormous applause. Huge rock amps boomed out the message, which resounded off the buildings, echoing over a huge crowd. We have declared an end to business as usual, a woolly-looking prof was shouting. An end to standing by while our leaders continue this despicable war. He was an officer of the faculty senate, one of the guys who'd been happy 2 nights ago about booting Edgar. He cried out for peace, and the crowd shouted back to him. The whole world is watching, they chorused spontaneously at the end of his address. For a moment, I let myself believe it. I fondled my passion and my hope like a precious toy. I clutched them, embraced them, then looked at my watch and put them all aside. I only had 40 minutes left. Africa House was located in one of the old red brick dorms. The Afro-American students, as they recently had begun calling themselves, had swapped and cajoled and intimidated their way into a block of 30 rooms. Residency in Africa House was limited solely to members of the Negro race. It was intended as a separate paradise where everybody wore khakis and called each other brother and could debate issues of politics and culture of unique concern to the residents. Whenever I passed by, the music blaring from the windows was great. Miriam Makeba, Junior Walker, The Miracles. The soundtrack of my high school years. The Campus Daily carried competing editorials regularly, debating whether this kind of separation was desirable. Having accepted from an early age that there was no more stupid way to judge a human than by skin color, I regarded the formation of Africa House as irrational and deeply destructive. But its existence was by now an accepted fact. A portrait of Malcolm X in day-glow shades had been painted on the doorway, over which the Ghanaian flag fluttered. Here, too, the strike banners hung from the windows in an unexpected showing of solidarity. In the corridor, a soul sister in shades and a high natural took her time when I asked for Hobie Tuttle. She was reading Cain at an old school desk, hauled in from a classroom. There were slogans from Frederick Douglass and Martin Luther King Jr. inscribed on the walls.
Who you?
I told her, friend, roommate.
You a knock?
You want to search me? Search me. I lifted my hands from my sides. The room where I found Hobie about 10 minutes later was tiled entirely in black and white. Large squares, 18 inches on a side. They covered not only the floor, but the walls and ceilings as well. The first impression was of looking into a kaleidoscope. When I pushed open the door, Hobie sat across the room, slumped in a corner, beside a simple dresser of university issue, which had been refinished in dull black contact paper. He was wearing a long leather coat. My initial thought was that he was sick or drunk, but he smiled with enough sureness that I knew he had his bearings. There was a large silver pistol on the tile beside him, a few inches from his hand. I had never seen a gun before in my life, except in the holster of a cop, and I stared at it for quite some time. "You gonna shoot me?" He issued a wan smile and motioned me inside. I lifted a hand to the walls. "Psychedelic.
It works.
If you pass through the looking glass, I got night sweats and it's 4:15. How you hanging, dude?"
"Feeling groovy," he answered.
He looked bad. Through his color, his nose was reddened at the bridge and on the nostrils. His scruple against coke appeared to have eroded at a time of distress. He told me this was once Cleveland's pad, one of his locations. "Cleveland's in pretty deep, huh?"
"Oh, you know, man. The pigs planted that shit. You know that. Pigs just can't handle this nasty colored boy in law school."
That was the story the Panthers had put out. Whoever had replaced Eldridge Cleaver as Minister of Information had been on the radio calling Cleveland's arrest a setup. But we'd all heard this tune too many times now. Between Hobie and me, the gloom of all our differences settled in this spirited rendition of this sad little lie. "I'm heading to Canada," I told him.
"Yeah," he said. "Old Loopy Lucy Lou says she's gonna truck on with you."
"That's what she tells me. She needs to get away. She's been doing this heartbreak thing."
"That's how it is," Hobie said.
"That's how it is," I answered. "So, if you hear the Mounties are saying groovy instead of we always get our man, you'll know why." I wanted badly to amuse him. I wanted him to be what he had always been, my friend. He smiled somewhat. "I was kind of hoping you'd have come around to say farewell."
"Well, you know how it is, man. I got a few serious problems here. Kind of laying low."
"Somebody looking for you?"
"Could be, yes. Sort of hoping no."
I wasn't sure how much I could ask. With his unfaltering ear for language, Hobie had mastered the urban accent that had never been his. His father, I knew, would slap him if he heard him talking like that. That was the point, I guess. Hobie'd taken everything his father had wanted him to care about and put it in another generation's wrapper. 2,000 miles away, removed from the vast penumbra of Gurney's influence, he was going about the business of being a man on his own terms. As was so often the case with Hobie, I found no comfort in any comparisons to myself. From far away on the quad, a cheer went up. The strikers were making noise. Hobie, with a weary immobility, looked back toward the window, where a black shade was drawn, and made an elderly sound.
"These kids got Tricky in a tight spot, man. He just gonna have to stop that war, or else they ain't never gonna go back to school."
Hobie was tickled by the thought. "They're doing what they can, Hobie." He lifted a hand. He didn't really care. We waited. "We talking ARC? I asked. "Is that your problem?" He didn't stir, as he mulled answering.
"I didn't do shit, but what you know about, if that's what you're asking. Then again, seems as how that may be enough. Been hearing about a fingerprint on that piece of a can they picked up."
"Oh, Hobie. Jesus Christ." After the first wave of distress, I realized this was what June must have meant.
"I get all this from one of Cleveland's fucked up comrades. These dudes, you know, could just be blowing my mind. On the other hand..."
Hobie actually lifted the gun and put it to his temple.
"Sucker might come in handy."
he smiled. Or shoot the pig comes through the door for me. Very briefly, he pointed the pistol in my direction. Let's do a retake on that one. Hobie shrugged. I could be right about that. So, what's your bad dream here? I asked. Is Cleveland talking? Is that it? If Cleveland was strung out, he would be easy to roll. He might even have turned over by now. Although, the Edgars claimed that Cleveland's weekend visitors had bucked him up. Hobie denied there was any cause for concern.
Cleveland, man. Cleveland's the baddest mother ever shipped between two shoes.
So, he's not talking?
He ain't talking, unless he wants to talk. You know, maybe he said some things. Maybe he's trying to catch a few fools' attention.
I could hear in the steady drumbeat with which these assurances rolled that Hobie had uttered them often in the last few days.
See, man, this is just, you know, a little internal struggle. Eldridge and Huey, man, Huey is kind of a strange motherfucker, can be very abstract about stuff, very cold. He's gonna be coming out any day now. Cleveland was more in with Eldridge and them. Now Huey's saying, you know, like peddling dope and all. That isn't any kind of revolutionary act, you know? And all the fucker's really meaning is that the party didn't get a righteous enough peace.
I nodded.
So, you know, Cleveland, man, he's feeling a distinct lack of solidarity. I mean, there are 20,000 people in the streets of New Haven for Bobby, and back here, nobody can't even be bothered to throw Cleveland's bail. Maybe the brother said something to attract some attention. But that's dialogue, man, dialectics. This is an ideological debate, you know? Stalin and Lenin.
And which one's going to tell on you, Hobie? Stalin or Lenin? He gave me a sick smile to show he did not enjoy being mocked. He never had. If Cleveland turns, that's your ass, right?
Cleveland ain't turning. Not on no brothers, that's for sure.
I knew he was persuading himself. But even with what he admitted, that Cleveland might give up a few Ofays, I could see what worried the Edgars.
You could turn first, Hobe. You know, you didn't do anything. You could explain.
Ain't no snitch.
He lowered his voice. He gestured with the gun.
They all'd kill my ass anyway.
That was what Bobby was on trial for in New Haven, killing an informer. I could have chided Hobie, pointed out what a mess he'd made for himself, but today it would have been hypocritical. If I told him what I was doing with the Edgars, there'd be no end to the names he'd call me. We'd both been overcome by something that still seemed to me to have started out so right. It was like a party where the good times, the music, the dancing, the girls, the excitement, had unaccountably led to disaster. I felt sorry for us both. For your information, the Edgars seem to have a plan for Cleveland's bail, so maybe you can holster your weapon. He should be on the street soon.
The Edgars,
said Hobie.
Fuck. Ain't nothing come free with them.
But you'll be okay then, right? He moved his shoulders in the same inconclusive way he'd done a number of times already. He didn't really know. It might be better. A moment passed. Are you scared? I asked him. He considered that, the sorrowful brown eyes dead still on me. The Panthers didn't know fear.
This here, man, is Vietnam. It's like a bad trip wide awake, and you ain't got that little edge to hold to, telling yourself that it's bound to wear off. I haven't slept but an hour, 2 hours in 2 days. The wrong dude comes through that door. These are the days of our lives, Bubba.
So, get the hell out of here. Put on your PF flyers and jump higher and run faster than anybody else. Come to Canada. How about that?
Hope and Crosby do another road movie?
A familiar whimsy shot through his face, then wore away. He shook his head no, decisively.
I'm cool here. Bros be looking out for me.
When I left, he roused himself and, after an instant of deliberation in which he pretended to be staggering around, raised his arms, and returned my embrace. He kept the pistol in his hand for the instant we were connected. When I turned for the door, he spoke a few words to me in French, one of his typically stylish gestures, although he knew it was a language I didn't speak. I caught the words, "Mon ami." I was sure it was a movie line, but I couldn't recall the picture. When I got back to the campus travel motel, Edgar was there. I had taken the key, and when I came in, I had an odd sense I was intruding on some intimacy, although there was nothing lewd about the pose in which I found June and him. They were seated on the facing sides of the twin beds, their heads drawn close. Clearly, they'd been whispering, defeating some unknown surveillant, controlling the random element. As I entered, Edgar's face shot around, the intense blue eyes riveted, as always, by anger and suspicion.
"My lord, Seth, we've been sitting here hoping like hell, just hoping they didn't run into you."
"Who's that?" Edgar looked at June. From the thick smell of her cigarettes and the butts in the ashtray, I could see they had been talking quite some time, probably as long as I'd been gone.
"Apparently we've had visitors at the apartment building, asking questions," she said.
"What kind of questions?" I asked.
"I didn't see them," Edgar said. "Michael talked to them. I spoke to him over the phone. He said they were asking about you, how long since you were last seen, who was with you then, any signs of struggle, unusual sounds last night."
"Bullshit," I said.
"I wish it were," said Edgar.
"What did he tell them?"
"Nothing," said Edgar. "He didn't know anything. He was on his way to look over his lab, so he didn't have time. You know how hard it is to get a word out of him normally. But it's damn clear to me they thought you'd been kidnapped."
"God, who? Who was it?"
"Michael said they showed him credentials."
Edgar looked briefly to June, before me.
"It was the FBI," he said.
December 11th, 1995. Sunny. Often, there are evenings out, unavoidable occasions. On these nights, I race home to fetch Nikki from aftercare, feed her, and with luck, get her in PJs. Then Marta Stern's live-in nanny, Everarda, an effervescent Nicaraguan immigrant, takes over. She has been filling in for me for years now, when Marta has no plans herself. Early to bed, Everarda prefers to stay over in the small first-floor guest room behind the kitchen, walking the three blocks back to Marta's at dawn. It's a wonderful arrangement for me. Nikki loves Everarda and her accent, which she imitates with uncanny accuracy, even in her most pettish moments, to the woman's face. Everarda pays no mind. She is one of those women who know that the real purpose of the world, unaffected by couturier dresses, rap albums, or political payoffs in the men's room of the Club Delancey, is the nurturance of children, and that in that critical field, no one exceeds her wisdom. She calls Nikki Nina, and moves her through her evening routine as smoothly as if my daughter were a puppet on strings. With her overnight bag, Everarda comes in, shaking off the snow which has just begun falling and lies thick on the false fur collar of her coat. She is full of gossip. Marta, pregnant with her third baby, is varicose and swollen and put out with her husband, Solomon, a management consultant.
"Solomon, he gone all the time. She were yelling, you know. He got to come home. He give her kisses, he send her flowers, he just smile."
Everarda smiles too at Solomon's patience. He is a thin, dark man. His family are expats, Jews from Cuba who arrived there in the 17th century. He's as dark as someone Maltese or Sri Lankan, a person bred of the blood of many nations. Tonight's event is a retirement dinner for Cyrus Ringler, former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, for whom I clerked for a couple of years right after law school. Law clerks spend their first year or two as lawyers, an intensely formative period, at a judge's side, seeing firsthand how the flesh of real life hangs on the raw bones of law school learning. Much as racehorses are always identified by sire and dam, clerks are forever known by their judges, and it is perhaps my proudest heritage in the law to be a Ringler clerk. Accordingly, I must go tonight. I drive faster than I should through the pelting snow to the center city, parking in the indoor lot at the Hotel Gresham. I walk across the street to the Parker, where Justice Ringler is being saluted by the City of Hope. It's the end of cocktails, just as the 500 lawyers and Pauls and judges are moving to their seats, making their last efforts to work the room. I hold a number of conversations at bay, so I can get close enough to the elevated dais to make sure Cy Ringler sees me. He blows a kiss and waves. From his color, I can tell he's already a little drunk, enjoying his last hurrah. A former Kendall County PA, the justice, as I will forever call him to his face, is one of those redoubtable men of the law who gathered respect as he rose by refusing to break the rules for political purpose. He was not inflexible or unrealistic, but he always knew the outer limits. Even so, he was a fabulous compromiser around the court. He hated dissents, felt they diminished the authority of decisions, and loved to find procedural gimmicks allowing divisive issues to be passed back to the lower courts. Marjo, who's had cancer twice in the last 5 years, is beside him, wasted-looking but bearing up. She must fly a hairdresser in from the Corn Belt. Where else could she even find somebody to do her hair like that, tightly curled and flattened down around her ears like a bonnet? Oddly, in this environment, surrounded by most of the Tri-City's legal notables, I feel more than anywhere else the extraordinary attention Niall Edgar's trial has generated. My neighbors in U Park are too circumspect to speak to me about my job. It has been no task, given my schedule, to avoid the papers and the news. I've caught sight of headlines now and then, but it's only tonight I fully sense how closely the case is being watched. Everyone passes a word about it. "Ooh, you got a hot one," Manny Escobedo, another of the Supreme Court justices, tells me. Cal Taft, a bar president, remarks, "I don't have to ask what you've been doing, do I?" I glow with the neon of celebrity. The judges all quietly inquire how the bastard cornered me into a bench trial. I smile and keep my answers nondescript, which, in the strange ballet of accepted mannerisms at work here, is taken as a perfect response. Seated at a table of former Ringler clerks and their spouses, I endure the usual struggle getting a vegetarian meal. The waiters in their cutaways look at me as if I'm a heathen. Who wouldn't want that baked chicken, rigid as a hockey puck? I have asked to sit next to Mylon Dornich, who was my co-clerk for a year. When I split with Charlie, Mike Dornich was one of those guys who came to mind, mild, angular, witty. With Marta one night, watching Nikki play with Clara, Marta's older daughter, I confessed these thoughts. Marta was alarmed. "Jesus, Sonny," she whispered. "He's gay." I realized instantly she was right, and felt amazed by myself, the way we forever see others through the lens of our own needs. Always happy for one another's company, Mike and I whisper together, conspiring over the absurdity of the event. The $200 I spent for two tickets, one of them unused, is a mild extravagance. Many lawyers from our era have rounded the bend into Plum law firm partnerships. Daniela Grizzi, my immediate predecessor in Ringler's chambers, makes millions every year in her PI practice and is listed as a $10,000 patron of the event. Only Mike Dornich, now second in command at the state appellate defenders, and I remain in the public sector, the poor mice at a banquet of fat rats. The dessert and speeches come together. It's a work night and everybody wants to be gone by 9:30. I kiss Mike and slip out before the crowd. In the vast carpeted reception room where cocktails were served and name tags applied, I catch sight of Chief Judge Brendan Toohey. Three highballs along, he is glad-handing and waving to other early escapees as he returns from the men's room. He greets me in a mood of après-work geniality, his nose red as sunburn from the lick of whiskey. He seems so happy, I'm afraid he might even kiss me. "Sonny, Sonny," he says,
How are you this evening?
He takes my hand and with the other grips me near the shoulder in an impressively neutral way.
I've been meaning to give you a call. So your trial is going on, Sonny?
Yes, Chief, I answer, despairing as ever over the ludicrous salutation.
Which tribe did I join?
The judges all call each other by first names, old boy stuff. But I could never bring myself to Brendan with this man.
Seems to be quite a Donnybrook mess.
Yes, sir. He shakes his head in wonder at the tirelessness of human disputes. With a jolly smile, I beg off and hurry into the little corridor where the cloakroom and the Johns are secreted. In the full-length mirror beside the coat check, I look myself over. Good enough. Black sheath and pearls. All those years of looking for a style of my own, not camp, not trite, not hippie or yippie or yuppie or commercial, have resolved themselves in a sort of residue of fashion that says, I don't have the time to fuss too much with hair or makeup. A look of having let go gratefully of a little of the heat and glory of the past. Just as the young girl hands back my coat, I hear my name once more from behind. Tui again. Something slipped his mind. I have one of those instants of alarm the chief judge always provokes. Brendan Tui can turn a corridor, even a well-lit one, into a sinister enclave. He comes one step too close. Glad I caught you. His voice is lowered, and he speaks between his teeth.
Happen to see Matt Galliacost tonight?
I've nearly asked who, when I recollect. Galliacost is the state chair of the Democratic Farmers and Union Party. The people who count, with Brendan Tui, would no more fail to recognize Galliacost's name than John the 23rd's.
Interested in your trial, says Tui.
I guess he'd been looking at tonight's news.
Loves Lloyd Edgar.
Course we all do. Lloyd, I marvel. Lloyd. Tui's tongue actually appears as he wets his lips.
Says to me, he says, what's that gal doing? Don't she know we're in the same party? I thought she was a friend of his.
Tui laughs. Oh, he's merry. He shivers in glee and is gone at once. His step, spry with power and feigned delight, never again meeting my eye. Not because he's afraid of what he's done. He can tiptoe down the line as precisely as Nijinsky. Or because he hopes to mute his message, invisible and awful as the odor of plague. No, he wants to give me time. So I recognize it's in my interests to comply. He's some kind of genius, this man, with his narrow, crafty, wizened face. He couldn't have done this better if he'd staged rehearsals. All the phony confidentiality.
We love Lloyd Edgar. We're in the same party. Thought you were a friend of his.
I've been at the law a dozen years, a clerk, a prosecutor, a judge, in each role wearing the borrowed mantle of public power, and have never faced anything like this. I stand here in the hall, alone in the bank of deep shadow between the sconces, weakened by rage. Despite repeated tries, I can get only one arm into my coat. Half frantic, I give up and ride down the escalator, clutching the free sleeve against my side under my purse. But like the victim always, I feel cheapened and shamed. A few weeks ago, Brendan Tui was the one giving me all that malarkey. You're the right judge for this case, Sonny. Tricky situation, but it comes with the robes. All the stuff I wanted to hear. And now he tells me the real reason, so I can smooth things out for my friend Edgar. For God's sake. I'm sick, as ill as if I'd stepped from a rocking boat, when I catch my reflection in the Parker's revolving doors and see the truth. I've compromised myself. I stayed on a case I should have given up, and now must stand still while a mangy alley cat like Brendan Tui rubs his flanks against me. I rush across the street, high heels clacking on the glistening pavement of Mercer Avenue, which is rimed with salt and snow. By the time I reach the lobby of the Gresham, I'm actually shaking. I lay my hand over my chest and grip the pearls at my throat. In the old days, a judge who complied with a communication like this received a visit and an envelope a few weeks later from somebody connected, a lawyer, a councilman. Now, discipline is a matter of negative reinforcement. Brendan Toohey can send me to housing court to listen to the endless lament of deadbeat tenants, or to night narcotics court so I'll never see Nikki during the week. Send me for the good of the court with no other explanation. That's what I'm supposed to think about while he slides off to let Galliacos know the word has been delivered. Can I even drive? I'm desperate, as so often frantic for someone to talk to. I can't call Cy Ringler tonight. Sandy Stern, he'll know what to do. In fact, he already foresaw the very situation. There were a dozen friends, colleagues who were jealous when word leaked that Ray Horgan had called to sound me about the bench. Stern alone, among the persons whose advice I cared for, warned me against it. "Pay no attention," he told me. "Dismiss what Raymond Horgan and his reform commission promise you." Stern's soft face, with the tiny dark eyes surmounted in plump flesh, was suddenly reproachful as I recited Horgan's commitments. A felony court assignment within 2 years. Complete independence. I must have sounded to him like Shirley Temple. Stern leaned across the linen cloth at the matchbook, where we were eating, probably stifling the impulse to wag a finger. "For today, Brendan Toohey needs you and your spotless reputation. 2 years from now, the commission will be an amusing part of history, one more toothless sop of briefly agitated public opinion, and they will force you to choose between your fine assignment or succumbing to their ways. You are not the first, Sonia. This, I remind you, is Kindle County, where great capacities of human invention have been set for a century on devising systems utterly invulnerable to reform." At the bank of telephones in an alcove, I probe the recesses of my purse. Nearby, the lobby of the Gresham, a towering space constructed in the Gilded Age, churns with sound and emotion. Dramatic marble columns, the size of sequoias, offset by long curtains of green velvet, extend the entire height of the room. 5 floors above, the ceiling is encrusted with gilt and cherubim and a poor Italianate mural of Venus and Cupid. On the marble shelf before the phones, I begin removing items. Kleenex, lipstick. Where's the damned address book? When I was younger, I could have remembered the bloody number. Stern is not at home. I could call Marta, but she tends to show a tough, inflexible side on matters like this. She'll badger me to report it. To whom, for God's sake? And how do I keep these events from turning against me? Toohey is too cagey to catch. He'll change a word or two and portray his remarks as innocuous, and me as hypersensitive and unfit. Within a week, his minions will be clamoring for my resignation. And then I realize that Seth is staying here, in this hotel. Seth! The thought of him, reliable, open, happy to help, is an inspiration. "Mr. Weissman," I tell the operator when I move down 2 bays to the house phone. There is no Weissman. "Frayne," I say. It's rung twice, when I suddenly slam the handset down. "Seth," I think. Am I crazy? Tell Seth? Hobie's friend? I lay my fingertips, bloodless, frigid against my forehead. Leaning over the small shelf beneath the house phones, awaiting my composure, I catch, incongruously, a sudden, pleasant scent of my own perfume. If I phone Stern's office, I'll get his service. A criminal defense lawyer is like a doctor, always on call, available for midnight bailings, visits to a crime scene. They'll locate him. I'll remonstrate mildly, say he told me so, then figure out what to do. And then, naturally, isn't that life? I spot Seth across the lobby. He's dressed casually, in the white dress shirt he wore to court and a pair of khakis. He has magazines in one hand and, I think, a candy bar. Observed from 100 feet, he appears humble and appealing. A tall, slender man, blondish, bald, pleasant-looking. He is chatting with a desk clerk. After a week and a half in the hotel, he has acquaintances. He's being himself, wholesome and engaging. He laughs, and then by whatever magic there is in this, feels the weight of my glance from a distance, and actually jolts a bit at the sight of me. He comes my way so quickly that he's gone several yards before he recollects the clerk, to whom he tosses a departing wave. Arriving in front of me, he is perfectly still. "Hi," I answer. "I was at dinner here. Across the street, actually." "Jeez, you look fantastic." He does a real routine, mouth open, ending by quickly touching his heart. As if makeup and hairspray turned me into Helen of Troy. I manage an expression of pleasant tolerance. "I'm not feeling fantastic at the moment. I had something really, really rotten happen to me just now." Beneath the fair brows, his greenish eyes search me. I hold up my hand. It quakes involuntarily as if I'd been struck by palsy. The display nonplusses us both. "You want a drink?" "God, do I." We set off together for the saloon across the lobby and actually reach its swinging doors. Mingled voices and the jazz piano well out of the dark room. Before my eyes adjust, I can make out only a large illuminated aquarium behind the bar, through which angelfish and other bright tropical creatures travel amid the bubbles. A quarter of the lawyers in Kindle County will be in here shortly, pausing for a nightcap before they ride up the parking elevator to collect their cars. Brendan Toohey, who has watered himself in this place for years, is among the likely arrivals. Not the company I want to keep right now. "Forget it," I say. "Bad idea." "What?" "Appearances," I answer. "So come upstairs. We'll raid the minibar in my room. Come on." When I issue a prim look, he makes a face. "Don't be ridiculous." With my elbow in hand, he steers me into the old gilded elevator, a gorgeous cage of brass and mirrors. "So what happened?" he asks as we are rising. "I don't know, Seth," I answer, which is almost true. "I had an unpleasant encounter with another judge. Something about this case." "Uh-oh." His mouth narrows in a discreet pucker, and he says no more until we reach his rooms. There, I fall into a barrel chair with a cane backing which is just inside the door. Seth's suite is the real thing, a relic of the grand era when suites were the refuge of the rich and not a promotional toy offered like a free breakfast. There are mock heirloom pieces with Queen Anne feet and satin-sheened wallpaper with a classic green stripe. Seth is at home here. He has a laptop computer open on the desk in the corner, and the walnut doors of the armoire, which holds the minibar where he's bending, have been thrown back, revealing the dead eye of the TV. Newspapers from many different cities litter the room. In the bedroom, I can see a four-poster with those carved wooden pineapples atop the posts. Another pair of khakis has been heaved over one of them. I just need to settle down for a second. I bolt half the Chardonnay he gives me. You don't want to talk about this, right? I shouldn't, Seth. I just need some company. Somebody passed a remark about Edgar. It's smarter not to get into it. Yeah, says Seth. That he belongs in the seventh circle of hell, right? He laughs bitterly. God, I despise him. What a heinous creep he is. I do not answer. Do not dare. What am I supposed to do for Edgar? I wonder suddenly. I don't even know. A momentary fear takes hold that I might conform to Tui's wishes by accident. Considering that prospect, I emit a brief moan. But I have no choices now. With a few minutes to absorb all this, I can see that there's no backpedaling, no sidesteps. The only direction to go is forward. I have to finish as well as I can what I should never have started. As I cycle through these calculations, Seth watches, his eyes watery with uncertainty. I can't talk to him about this, I realize. not him or anybody else. That's the only true thing, too, he said to me. Comes with the robes. It's my problem. Alone. I'm going to go, Seth. Wow, he says. Is this the Guinness record for brief visits? I just needed a second. I appreciate your being the port in the storm. I stand, taking hold of the ornate brass doorknob. I drain the rest of the wine. Really? I add. Thanks. Just a second, he says. I'll kiss you goodnight. He makes no move to rise. He's in a wooden armchair, upholstered in satin to match the wallpaper, laughing at me. At both of us, actually. I think the last time will hold me for a while. Well, that'll make a fella feel like Prince Charming. Oh, don't do your wounded thing, Seth. No, I'm not wounded. He turns to the glass table beside him and pours himself more wine. By the time I got back here, I actually was pretty encouraged. You want to know why? A person, a woman, who was going to remain aloof, or at least unentangled, would say goodbye right now. I know that. But I'm curious, of course. He takes a sip to steady himself, and I feel myself make a measured nod. When I thought about it, he says, really considered everything, I wasn't sure you ever found anybody better. You know, than me. In shock, I laugh, a shot of sound that rebounds off the grand old walls. The gall, or something. And he means it. You don't understand, he says. I don't. I certainly don't. I mean, Seth, really. Some of the stuff you come out with. Look, he says. No, you look, I say, feeling an intense flare of the anger that I suddenly see I've been holding at bay. I'm 47 years old, and I'm like you. I'm unhappy, just like you are, Seth. I don't always enjoy the way my life turned out. I look back and wonder what happened to all the promise, just like you do. I envy people who are young and envision the future as something great. You're not the only one with angst. I'm tired of fucking up. I'm tired of making the same mistakes. At the worst moments, I'm sick of myself. And this, us, this isn't kidding around. And I'm running out of time for stupid things. I thought all weekend about how this would turn out, and I could just see it. Auld Lang Syne, and isn't it thrilling? Then, hey, I have a life. Sonny, it's stupid, I repeat. It's not. He puts down his glass and stands to calm me. I mean, I'm glad you're here. But you looked pretty damned happy to see me a minute ago. Yes, I was relieved. I need a friend. But that doesn't mean it's not dumb to retread a childhood love affair. It wasn't childhood, he answers at once. And it's not dumb. One thing I've learned, I will not treat the rest of my life like it's meaningless, just because it's past. In conviction, he briefly makes a fist, then takes a step forward and grips both of my shoulders. Look, I want you to take a deep breath, okay? You know me. I may be a quarter less crazy than I used to be, but I'm the same sincere dope. I think I know what I'm doing. I think I'm taking stock. Some things have mattered more than others. Some people have mattered more. You can fuck up with me like you can with anybody else. And maybe you will. But you're playing with a bigger bankroll if you get in the game with me. I knew Zora. I saw that whole scene. I saw your collection of black peasant blouses so you wouldn't have to worry about what to wear, and how scared you'd get when you were afraid your skin was going to break out. And I've seen what you've accomplished off that start, which is a hell of a lot. There are maybe 3 billion men on this planet, Some are smarter, some are better looking, and most of them have more hair. But I've got one advantage over every single one of them. I know how great you are, and I'm not sure you've ever met another man who does. He takes the wine glass, which unconsciously I've continued holding, and gazes at me in a fixed way. The look. All mating primates, I learned once, utilize this dilated, dead-on stare. You know what happens now? He asks. You kiss me goodnight? Not goodnight, he says. When he leans down, a trace of exasperated sound escapes me, but I do not resist. That great creature, hunger, begins to stir. In the cascades of longing, I will lose track of myself. And who will be here afterwards? I wonder. Who? So, it happens. Outside, fresh snow clings to the city streets, and within the bedroom of the suite, the exterior light is softly refracted, so the air seems enhanced by the glow, which includes darker, purplish shades from the lee end of the visible spectrum. Between us, it is surprisingly smooth. Memory, knowledge, the past brings its comforts. In the living room, urgently embracing, we shed our clothes. Some wary, calculating portion of me continues to stand guard, but I'm a slave now to sensation. Even that awful moment, the one I have numbed myself to with so many half-conscious mental rehearsals, when my bra slides off and the lopsided work of modern surgery is disclosed, sluices by in the currents of desire. This is one promise Seth has kept. He is not afraid, not of anything about me, or that the present is not the past. God, sex is great. The body made servant to the spirit. His tongue is everywhere. Finally, he bodies me down on the four-poster, my feet still on the floor, and stands before me, erect, pointing north by northwest, as he fiddles with the condom wrapping. Then the slow opening, enveloping the pressure and pleasure of merger. Slow, baby, I whisper. Slow. Unable to recall if it's an honest memory or merely fantasy that I whispered this to him long ago. I come last, throbbing by the end, on the wilted heap of him. Afterwards, we lie together in the bed. He grabs the quilted spread, which we did not bother to remove, and wraps it around us. We are surrounded by the smells of hotel linen. That didn't take long, I finally say. To get back there, I'd say I was right about everything. I'd say I was horny. We laugh, just giddiness. Life can be all right. What do you think the biological function is of female orgasm? I ask. You mean how it happens? From a Darwinian perspective, men have to come to spill their seed. It's directly related to reproduction. But what do you think nature gets out of letting women feel so good? I think it's what they call an incentive. Remember green stamps? But as long as men were so inclined and women had this profound desire to be mothers, considering, I pause. Sex isn't pleasurable for all species. Aren't there cats? Panthers, I think. The male has a barb at the end of his business, and as he withdraws, she actually snarls and screams. It's the barb that causes ovulation. I learned that ages ago. Wasn't it with you? Wrong boyfriend. No, I'm sure we used to go to the zoo and watch those large cats make it. He laughs. He was putting me on. I didn't realize voyeurism was the motive, Seth says. My recollection, Judge, is that we were taking Niall. Jesus, I mutter. He's right. My heart, in reflex, freezes over and I grow silent with the complications. Beneath the coverlet, his fingers trace and retrace the grooved stretch marks left years ago on the good breast by the period of explosive growth I went through at 10, 11, 12. I have asked all the doctors if there could be a relationship between that hormonal surge and cancer. They only shrug. Seth sits up now, swinging his legs over the edge of the bed. The sight of the older man remains marginally surprising. He is still lean, but his skin holds less color, less tone. There is the inevitable fleshy gathering at the waist, and his back, as he slumps, shows the slightest bow. He is pensive, as we both are, in the aftermath. I don't think much of this Darwin stuff, he says. What would Darwin say about music? What's the survival function of that? And it exists in every culture. It makes me happy. Like your orgasm. Maybe nature wants us to be happy after all, Seth. Do you think that's possible? He doesn't take an instant. Nope. Don't happy people live longer? Isn't there research? Isn't there something tonic to the organism in enjoying the whole grand show? Then I'm doomed, he says. I'm on borrowed time. His delivery is good, and I feel lighthearted and laugh as he intends. You still think you can achieve nirvana? He asks me. Not nirvana. But you're happy. Happier than when we were young. Like you said, I feel I've accomplished things. I love my child. I'm proud I'm a good parent. I'm a good judge. I wait then to see if I believe what I have said, if some internal truth meter will buzz in disbelief, but it goes down without a tremor. Seth, in reply, is quietly shaking his head. I don't know many happy anything, Sonny. Not lawyers, not journalists, not Indian chiefs. You're in no position to assess that, Seth. After what you've been through, it's too soon. 2 years? I would have thought. He lifts a hand. When it happened, he takes a breath. When he died. There was so much of that disconnected feeling from nightmares, you know? Where you're reaching inside to grab hold of whatever part of your soul provides reassurance the terror isn't real. But of course, what I recognized 4 times a day was that I wasn't getting out of this one. There was nothing better to wake to. I walked through months like that, and there are times now when I realize that period has never really ended. Even now, back in Seattle, he cannot walk north from the house, he says. Down the block, a few doors, there's a house where they poured a new walk 4 years ago, and Isaac, in a typically ungovernable mood, wrote his name with a stick, carving the ragged letters 1/2 inch deep with his own special mix of strength and fury. The neighbors were so angry they stopped speaking to Seth, even to Lucy. Now the boy is dead, and the name is still there. He has gone by once or twice, Seth says, and just dissolved. What a sight. A man in a trench coat standing on an empty walk before a house where the occupants still hate him, weeping so fiercely that you know he feels he will never remember how to stop. I comfort myself in the most ridiculous ways. I mean, this is nothing compared to the legendary blows of history. I think about what my parents went through. But, you know, he looks at me. There's no relativity to suffering. I hold him for quite some time, something I have yearned to do since he first told me. Then he goes out to the living room. He brings wine back for both of us. Have you tried therapy, Seth? Was that a joke the other day about treatment? I have been in therapy longer than Woody Allen. What about you? surgery, divorce. I took my turn. It helps. It helps, he says, but shakes his head. Then he puts the glass down somewhat precipitously on the Louis-something night table, saying he knows what he needs. When he returns, he stands naked before the bed, that fox amid the bushes still red and glistening. He sings a few bars from Steely Dan. He opens his palm, displaying a joint. I actually jolt a bit. Where did that come from? Is this a habit? Hobie, he says. The one word is explanation enough. How about it? Old time's sake? You're kidding. Sure, I'll get my guitar. We can have a hootenanny. Don't forget the red light bulb and the towel to stuff under the door. I fear he's gone to get them, but when he returns from the living room again, it's merely a pack of matches he's brought. He surrounds himself in a bouquet of smoke. I haven't been this close to the odor in years. Occasionally, there's an amusing fugitive whiff as some teenaged goof passes on the street, or a single breath taken in as something wafts in from the distance in a park or at a concert. I don't, I say, when he offers it. I haven't since I got my law license. Oh, bullshit, he answers in disapproval, not doubt. I'm being conformist, still a generational sin. Something has to count, Seth. I suppose. He answers and picks up the pillows and seats himself behind me on the bed, pulling me back so that I lounge against him as he smokes, snug within the warmth of his legs and the leisure of our nakedness. And what is it that counts, I wonder suddenly? What great absolute can I name? In the land of laws, the one thing I promised myself would not occur has happened. In the great new age, I have found a way to bring myself to shame like the heroines of old-time novels, fucked my way to ignominy like Hester Prynne and Anna Karenina. And for just this moment, it does not seem to matter. No, that's not right. It matters even now that I'm not better or more honorable. It matters that I've tried and failed by some measure all my life. It will always matter. But it is, right now, just a fact, like many others. Like the glow of the moon, or the paths of the migrating birds. When he brings the joint back to my lips, I take it from him. The pungence and the raw taste of the smoke, more or less forgotten, for some reason, make me laugh. Seduced you, he says. You seem to be an expert. Oh, please. Have you fucked around a lot, Seth? He answers that he doesn't think of this as fucking around. I meant before. He takes another hit and peeks cutely around my shoulder. Is this an AIDS check or character assessment? The latter, I hope. What do you think? He asks. I don't know. I suppose I think yes, but maybe I'm trading in stereotypes. You know, sort of famous, sort of rich. I always think people like that get loose. Were you? The ember of the joint brightens like a lightning bug. You first, he says. I don't have anything to tell. Once, when I was a prosecutor, I fell half in love with the defense counsel in one of my cases, but that was temporary insanity. It only lasted a couple of days, and nothing came of it. He's fat and a lot older, and I was pregnant. Even telling the story, though, it occurs to me that what's going on right now fits my pattern. I only fall for men at the most unlikely moments, as if I need a time when my own security systems are not on high alert. That's it? That's it. He tokes again. Tell, I say. Among the many sad ways I've spent time in the last 20 years have been a couple of really hopeless affairs with women who offered me very little, except an admiring audience and the usual animal thrill. And what I discovered is that Life offers nothing more depressing than a relationship conducted solely within the wallpapered dimensions of an expensive hotel room. Did Lucy know? Yeah, but it was complicated. This was all before Isaac was born. We had a pretty rough spell then. Like this one? This isn't the same. Not at all. We're not angry. We just seem to be out of gas. Why were you angry then? Why was I angry? He repeats. Lots of reasons, but let's just say that Lucy's arms aren't her only limbs that have been open to humanity. Ah, their problems are getting clearer to me all the time. That makes people angry. I suppose. But I didn't start wandering to get even. I loved the idea of it. Of falling for someone. I still think it's the most thrilling thing in life. Does that sound corny? Or just weak? Weak. Yeah. He knows it. He looks down between his knees. That was the lesson I learned from you, though. The thrill. Right. I mean it, he says, and touches the joint to my lips again. It sounds like the song. What was his name? Something, something. Frank Ifield. He rolls back. I would, you know, say that. I turn away. I will not let him. What is this old fear? I still don't know, but I feel suddenly the presence of all.